your mind and inside you find a strange family eating supper. Now when I worked, I felt strange around the entrance to my own interiority. Was I actually just an invader, bearing smallpox-ridden blankets and lies? What secrets and mysteries lay undiscovered in there? I still felt weak, and I considered that I had died in that room with its drapes and pulls, and that the me who bent over my keyboard day after day was a ghost who was tethered to her work regardless of the fiddling details of her mortal coil. I woke up to moaning. I was standing at the base of the stairs, barefoot and in my pajamas. My loosened bun hung limply against my neck. I registered the wooden panels of the hallway, the moonlight streaming through the windows that surrounded the door. I had not sleepwalked in years, yet here I was, upright and elsewhere. I heard it again. I'd heard sounds like this before, when I was a child and our cat had eaten an entire loaf of bread. It was a sound of gluttony regretted, of wallowing in one's own excess. My feet made no sound as I padded across the hardwood floor. The hallway was cast in shadow. Moonlight slanted through a window, cutting three silver bars across the paneled walls. At the end of the hall, I descended the stairs and followed the sound toward the dining room. From the doorway, I could see Diego on his back on the table. Straddling his pelvis was Lydia, in her sea-foam nightgown, which was hitched up around her hips. The bottoms of her feet were facing me, dark with dirt. As Lydia undulated, I noticed patches of moonlight appearing and disappearing beneath her, bisected by darkness. My mind sleepily turned over once, twice, like a struggling engine, and then surged to life. He gripped her hips to pull her into him, and then push her away. The rhythm was organic, like wind rippling over the water. They did not seem to notice me. Lydia was facing away, and Diego's eyes were screwed shut, as if to open them would be to release some of his pleasure. The moonlight was overbearing, illuminating details that seemed impossible. The slickness of him, the sheer fabric that surrounded her flesh like an aura. I knew I should move. I should go back to my bedroom, perhaps rub out this mounting wave of pleasure and horror, and then sleep. But I could not. Their lovemaking seemed to go on, but neither appeared to climax, just rut with impossibly consistent tempo. After some time, I left them there. Back in my own room, I touched myself. How long it had been! And my mind was a jumble of static. I thought of my wife, the dark stain of her nipples, her mouth open and ribbons of sound coiling out. The next day, the mist returned. When I woke, it was hovering in my open window, like a solicitous spirit with something to tell me. I slammed it shut so hard the frame rattled. I felt disoriented from the previous evening. Should I say something to them? Ask them to be more discreet, perhaps? Or perhaps my inadvertent observation was only my problem and not theirs? In the kitchen, Lydia was making coffee, but I did not meet her eyes. In my cabin, I tried hard to focus. I stood out on my balcony and strained to see the lake, but I could not. Exhausted by the weather, I lay down on the floor. From there, the room changed utterly. I felt stuck to the ceiling by a force equivalent to, though the opposite of, gravity. And from here I could see the hidden spaces beneath the furniture. A mouse's nest, a stranger's index card, a lone bone-white button tilted on an axis. I was reminded, for the umpteenth time, of Viktor Shklovsky's idea of defamiliarization, of zooming in so close to something and observing it so slowly, that it begins to warp and change and acquire new meaning. When I'd first begun to experience this phenomenon, I'd been too young to understand what it was, certainly too young to consult a reference book. The first time, I lay down on the floor examining the metal and rubber foot of our family refrigerator, wreathed in dust and human hair. And from this reference point, all other objects began to change. The foot, instead of being insignificant, one of four, etc., suddenly became everything. A stoic little home at the base of a large mountain, from which one could see a tiny curl of smoke and glinting illuminated windows. A home from which a hero would emerge, eventually. Every nick on the floor was a balcony or a door. The detritus beneath the fridge became a wrecked, ravaged landscape, the expanse of kitchen tile a rambling kingdom waiting for salvation. This was how my mother found me, staring at the foot of the refrigerator so intensely my eyes were slightly crossed, my body curled up, my lips moving almost imperceptibly. The second time is not worth explaining in detail, though it was the reason Mrs. Z's daughter transferred out of our shared high school English class, and by the third time, I was an adult then, I'd come to understand what it was that I was doing, and began to do it more consciously. This process has been useful for my writing. In fact, I believe that what talent I have comes not from some sort of muse or creative spirit, but from my ability to manipulate proportions and time. But it has put a strain on my relationships. How I married my wife is still a mystery to me. I finished the day's work long after dark. The fog had burned away by midday, and now everything was clear and sharp. The moon was nearing fullness, and glinted off the lake's waves, agitated by the wind. I set off through the trees, my feet crunching on rock. Everything shone with a thin, silvery light. I imagined myself a cat, night vision illuminating what was otherwise secret. The hotel glowed in the distance, a lighthouse, beckoning me home. But then, before me, liquid shadow spilled across my path, darker than the darkness. I tried to look past it. If I could reach the bench, I could reach the other side of the trees. But the flatness of the dark in the intervening woods was a horror. I pulled my bag tightly to my side. "You are a fool," I thought to myself. "You have been reading too much, and your mind is wound too tightly. You have been drowning in memory. Your wife? She would be embarrassed for you if she knew that you had drifted this far." But I could not take my eyes from the bench. The whiteness seemed transformed, as if it were no longer painted wood, but bone. As if 1,000 years ago, some creature had climbed out of the lake and died in this exact spot in anticipation of my arrival. Around me, black bushes roiled in the wind, and I did not see thorns before touching one. It sank into my index finger, and I sucked the wound as I walked. Perhaps this blood offering kept whatever was nearby at bay. I sucked and sucked, and then, at the other side of the shadows, the moonlight was restored. I did not look behind me. Anil suggested one evening at dinner that we get together to share the work we'd been doing. I balked, but the other seemed enthusiastic. "After supper?" Lydia suggested. I pushed my chicken around my plate, hoping that someone would register my displeasure. But no one seemed to notice. And so, as we digested, we looked at Diego's drawings, several panels of a dystopian world ruled by zombies thirsty for knowledge. Then the painter led us into her studio, but said nothing about her work. The walls were covered from floor to ceiling in tiny square canvases, with the same unsettling red design delicately painted on each one. They resembled handprints, but had an extra finger, and were entirely too small to be human hands. I was too afraid to examine them closely, to see if they were as identical as they appeared. When we got into Benjamin's studio, he was sweeping a space for us to stand in. "Careful," he said. "There's a lot of glass on the floor." I stayed near the wall. His sculptures were massive, assembled from clay and broken ceramic and window panes. Mostly they were mythical figures, but also there was a beautiful one of a naked man with a jagged slice of glass between his legs.
"I call that one William," Benjamin said when he saw me looking.
In Anil's studio, there were the photographs. "This is my newest series, The Artists," she said. Everyone moved to their respective images, drinking them in before looking at their neighbors. Lydia laughed, as if she were remembering some cheerful childhood dream. "I love it," she purred. "They're posed, but not posed." Each print was set in a different place around the property. Benjamin was lying next to the lake, muddied and bound in filthy strips of linen, limbless as a silk-wrapped fly. His eyes were open, fixed on the sky but glassy, reflecting a single bird. Diego was crumpled at the base of the hotel steps, body awkwardly jutting this way and that, his dark irises swollen with his dilated pupils. In Lydia's, she stood with her neck in a noose on the top of a stump and tipped forward, her arms outstretched, a serene smile on her face. And mine, well... Anil stepped next to me.
"What do you think?" she asked.
I did not remember that afternoon very clearly. All the action that passed before our breathless dart across the meadow was hazy, like a watercolor painting. But here, I looked completely, irrevocably dead. My body was crumpled like Diego's, as if I had been sitting demurely on the chair and then shot through the heart. Several of my many bandages were visible. My breast had slid out from underneath the sheet, this I did not remember, and there was nothing in my eyes. Or even worse, there was nothingness. Not the absence of a thing, but the presence of a non-thing. I felt as if I was seeing a premonition of my own death, or a terrible memory I'd long forgotten. Like the others, the composition was beautiful. The colors were perfectly saturated. I did not know what to say to her. That she knew perfectly well that she had betrayed my trust, that our beautiful afternoon was ruined, that I had been exposed in a way I had not intended, and that she should feel guilty about this exposure even though it was clear she did not? I could not look at her. I trailed the group as they went to Lydia's studio, where she played something for us. It was infuriatingly beautiful, a song in several movements that conjured an image of a terrified girl being chased from a manor, and then stumbling into the forest and nearly dying upon the banks of a surging river, and then transforming into a hawk. She then narrated the poem part, in which a young woman floated through space and meditated on the planets and her own life before the accident that had launched her from orbit. When it was my turn, I primly read a brief passage from the scene where Lucille rejects the gift from her old piano teacher, and then breaks into her house to retrieve it. "Standing before the blazing inferno," I concluded, "Lucille realized two terrible facts, that her childhood had been tremendously lonely, and that her old age would be, if possible, even worse." Everyone clapped politely and stood. We retired to the table, where we opened several bottles of wine. Lydia filled my glass to the brim. "Do you ever worry," she asked me, "that you're the mad woman in the attic?"
"What?"
I said. "Do you ever worry about writing the mad woman in the attic story?"
"I'm afraid I don't know what you mean."
You know, that old trope, writing a story where the female protagonist is utterly batty? It's sort of tiresome and regressive and, well, done. Here she gesticulated so forcefully that a few drops of red spattered the tablecloth. Don't you think? And the mad lesbian? Isn't that a stereotype as well? Do you ever wonder about that? I mean, I'm not a lesbian, I'm just saying. There was a beat of silence. Everyone was studying his or her glass closely. Diego reached his finger into his wine and removed some invisible detritus from the surface. She isn't batty or mad, I said finally. She's just a nervous character. I've never known anyone like that, Lydia said. She's me, I clarified. More or less, she's just in her head a lot. Lydia shrugged. So don't write about yourself. Men are permitted to write concealed autobiography, but I cannot do the same? It's ego if I do it?
To be an artist, Diego interjected, derailing the subject. You must be willing to have an ego and stake everything on it.
Anil shook her head. You have to work hard. Ego only creates problems.
But without ego, Diego said, your writing is just scribbles in a journal. Your art is just doodles. Ego demands that what you do is important enough that you be given money to work on it.
He gestured to the hotel around us.
It demands that what you say is important enough that it be published or shown to the world.
The painter frowned and said something, but I could not hear it, naturally. Everyone took deep sips of their wine. That night, I heard Lydia walk past my room. Through my door's crack, I could see her feet shuffling along the hardwood. She discarded her nightgown in the hallway, and as she turned into Diego's room, her nudity was like a blade unsheathed. I felt something strange move through my body. Once, when I was visiting my grandfather as a girl, I'd startled a garter snake out of the grass, and it had dived for the safety of the neatly assembled woodpile so fast that its muscular body snapped rigid before being slurped into the darkness. I felt this way now, as if I was plummeting somewhere so quickly my body was out of control. I crawled back into bed, and I had a dream. In it, I was sitting across from my wife, who was nude but wrapped in a gauzy fabric. She had a clipboard in her hand and was moving a pencil down it as if ticking off entries on a list.
"Where are you?"
she asked.
"Devil's Throat," I said.
"What are you doing?"
"Carrying a basket through the forest."
"What's in the basket?" I looked down, and there they were. Four beautiful spheres. 2 eggs, I counted. 2 figs.
Are you sure?
I did not look down again, afraid that the answer would change.
Yes.
And what is through the forest?
I do not know.
And what is through the forest?
I am not certain.
And what is through the forest?
I cannot tell.
And what is through the forest?
I don't remember.
And what is through the forest?
I woke up before I could answer. The objections returned. They were more plentiful. They spread to my stomach, my armpits. They grew large and had segments within, so when I lanced them, they crumpled chamber by chamber, like a temple from which an adventurer is feverishly tearing. I could hear their insides. They crackled, like pop rocks. I could hear them. I remembered from science class years ago that aging stars bloat and swell in their final days, before collapsing and then exploding in a hypernova. Hypernova. This is what it felt like, as if my solar system were dying. I soaked in the tub for a while. On this same day, I opened up my mind and remembered several scenes from my Girl Scout days. I remembered dropping a roasted marshmallow into the dirt of the fire pit and eating it anyway, the carbonized sugar and stones crunching in equal measure. I remembered sharing with my peers a list of interesting facts I'd memorized. Most white dogs are deaf. You should never wake sleepwalkers, but you may be able to gently guide their sleeping forms to bed. Cashews are related to poison ivy. I remembered eating all the graham crackers that our counselor had hidden in the bottom of the plastic food tub. When she asked us who had taken them, I did not answer. I remembered, in greater detail, my illness there, sleeping through the day on my cot, listening to the birds and the distant shouts of my comrades. The thought of events passing without my being there, of shared events and shared pleasure from which I was situationally excluded, caused me suffering beyond measure. I became very convinced that I was fine, and when I stood, I became so dizzy that I swooned back onto the taut fabric. It were as if I were a minor character in someone else's play, and the plot required me to stay there at that moment, no matter how I resisted. Perhaps that is what caused my grief. Here, at Devil's Throat, everything felt wrong. I became disgusted by my own dramatizations, and tried to imagine the opposite of what I felt, that my significant pain in that moment was of no significance whatsoever. That I was dwarfed by the smallest minutiae, the complex comedies and tragedies of insects, atoms dancing, a neutrino tunneling through the earth. To distract myself from my troubles, I decided to continue exploring the lake. I left my cabin and struck off toward where I'd seen the canoe, which was no longer there. I recognized the pulse of the water, however, and beyond that, the shore curved farther. I followed it for another half an hour or so, examining the pebbles and sand at the shore, breaking off tree limbs when they disrupted the outline of the woods. Eventually, I came to a small pier. No boats there, either. But I could practically feel the rough wood grain on the backs of my thighs, and there was a gap in the trees, marked by a slender red ribbon tied to the trunk. A path. I started down it. I felt certain this was the way. Indeed, before I reached each turn, I remembered the turn. But as though I was coming from the opposite direction. Had I taken the boat onto the lake? Or just sat on the pier? And next to me? Who had been next to me? An animal cried out, and I stopped. It was the sound of suffering, of fear or mating, and was objectively terrible. A fisher cat? A bear? But then, a young girl, no older than 5 or 6, was standing next to a tree. Her eyes were wide and wet, as if she'd been crying, but it stopped when she'd heard my footsteps galumphing on the forest floor. She was wearing shorts with knee socks and sneakers, and her neon green sweatshirt said, "Yes, I can be a top cookie seller," in bubble font. "Hello," I said. "Are you all right?" She shook her head. "Are you lost?" She nodded. I went over to her and showed her my palm. "If you'd like, you may take my hand and we can walk to the camp. You're with the Girl Scouts, right?" She nodded again and placed her soft little hand into mine. I did not expect it to be so precise. We started walking. I remembered the brownies story I told Neil, and it felt fortuitous that I'd come across a soul who could answer the inquiry I could not. "May I ask you a question?" I said. She nodded gravely and did not meet my eyes. "Finally, a kindred spirit. In Brownies, there's a rhyme. Do you know it?" I felt the shudder pass through her body and via her warm, sticky hand into my own. "I'm sorry," I said. "You don't have to say it." We walked a little farther. The path seemed more overgrown here than would be appropriate for a camp for young people.
"Twist me and turn me," the girl began. Her voice was reedy but strong, like a steel wire.
She faltered. I did not press. We continued to walk, breaking rhythm only when it was necessary to avoid a patch of poison ivy, where a beam of sunlight struck the oily leaves and they glistened.
"Twist me, and turn me, and show me the elf," she finished.
I looked in the water, and saw... She stopped, and I remembered.
"Myself," I whispered.
Horrifying. It was grotesque in the extreme. No wonder the rhyme had removed itself from my memory. Sending a child after an enslaved mythical brownie, and then providing a rhyme that, assuming the child did not fall into the pond and drown or get lost in the night, would only serve to tell the child that she herself was the enslaved mythical brownie? And not her brother, mind you, but her?
Every adult and speaking animal in that story was suspect, having either not taken proper care of the protagonist or actively sent her into harm's blundering path.
"I understand," I said to her. The path widened, and then there we were, at the edge of a campsite. A ways off, large military-style platform tents circled a blackened fire pit. A fresh stack of wood was nearby, draped in a blue tarp. To our left, there was a low, wide building, and in front of it, teenage girls were clustered around picnic tables. Sound gathered over them like smoke, conversation, clattering mess kits, the clank of ladle against pot, creaking benches, howls of laughter. One of them, lean and tan and wearing a baggy t-shirt with a bear on it, leaped up when we cleared the trees.
"Emily," she said, "how did you..."
"She was wandering in the woods," I said. I waited for her to ask me who I was or where I was from, but she didn't. She tilted her head a little, and there was something older in her features, something wry and correct. Perhaps she was waiting for me to ask where the adults were. But even though there were none in sight, I didn't. The question was hardly necessary. If the civilized world ended, these girls would go on forever, with their mess kits and bonfires and first aid and stories. And it wouldn't matter either way where the adults were.
"Thanks for bringing her back," she said. She took Emily's hand.
"You all look very happy," I said. "Very content." The girl smiled wanly, and her eyes glinted with an unspent joke.
"Thank you for our conversation," I said to Emily,
who blinked, and then ran toward the picnic benches, where the voices of the older girls greeted her in smatters.
"Goodbye," I said to the teenager, and then walked back into the trees.
When I emerged on the other side, the light had changed. I took off my shoes and walked to the edge of the water, and then in. It lapped up and slapped my legs.
"Twist me and turn me," I mumbled, circling slowly over the stones. They dug up into the soft arches of my heels.
"And show me the elf." I looked in the water and saw... When I tipped over and searched for my face, I saw nothing but the sky. On the first day of August, I opened my studio door to discover the lower half of a rabbit lying across my porch steps. Behind me, the cursor blinked in the middle of an unfinished sentence. Lucille did not know what was on the other side of that door, but whatever it was, she knew it would reveal... I knelt down before the unfortunate creature. The wind ruffled its fur. The back legs were loose, as if it were sleeping. Its visible organs glistened like caramels, and it smelled like copper.
"I'm sorry," I whispered.
"You deserved better than that." When I had collected myself, I gathered it up in a tea towel. I took the rabbit to the dining room of the hotel where Lydia, Diego, and Benjamin were laughing over mugs. I laid the bundle down on the table.
"What is it?"
Lydia breathed playfully, lifting the edge of the hem. She gasped and jumped out of her chair, her chest heaving with the force of a wretch.
"What's..."
Diego began. He leaned a little closer.
"Jesus."
"She's fucking crazy," Lydia howled. "I found it," I said, in front of my studio.
"It was probably an owl or something," Benjamin said. "I've seen a bunch of them around."
Lydia spat. "Oh, God, I'm so done. You're crazy. You're crazy. You just walk around mumbling and staring all of the time. What is wrong with you? You should be ashamed of yourself." I took a step toward her. "It is my right to reside in my own mind. It is my right," I said. "It is my right to be unsociable, and it is my right to be unpleasant to be around. Do you ever listen to yourself? This is crazy, that is crazy, everything is crazy to you. By whose measure? Well, it is my right to be crazy, as you love to say so much. I have no shame. I have felt many things in my life, but shame is not among them." The volume of my voice caused me to stand on my tiptoes. I could not remember yelling like this, ever. "You may think that I have an obligation to you, but I assure you that us being thrown together in this arbitrary arrangement does not cohesion make. I have never had less of an obligation to anyone in my life, you aggressively ordinary woman." Lydia began to cry. Benjamin grabbed my shoulders and steered me forcefully into the foyer.
"Are you okay?"
he asked. I tried to answer, but my head weighed 1,000 pounds. I bent toward him, pressing my scalp into his shirt. "I feel so sick," I said.
"Maybe you need to just go work in your studio for a while, or take a nap, or something."
I felt a plug of mucus release itself from my nose. I wiped it on my hand.
"You look terrible," he said.
I must have looked stricken at this, because he corrected himself.
"You look troubled." "Are you troubled?"
"I suppose I must be," I said.
"When was the last time you heard from your wife?"
I closed my eyes. So many letters sent off into oblivion. Never a letter for me. "You're the kindest one," I said to him. As I sat on my studio's deck that night, I considered the rabbit. I thought about the wind-strewn puffs of fur that had blown across the wood, the dark entrance to its torso. I swirled water in a wine glass. Many years ago, the night after I kissed Mrs. Z's tall daughter on the mouth on the dock, and felt something unfold inside me like a morning glory, I woke up in the darkness. How could I have known she'd shared none of my ecstasy? How could I have known that she was merely curious, and then afraid? It was not very different from waking up in my grandmother's spare bedroom, or on some finished basement floor surrounded by slumbering classmates. But unlike those moments, where confusion was followed by drowsy recognition of vacation or a sleepover, this disorientation did not resolve itself, for I had gone to sleep drunk on pleasure and warm in a cocoon of nylon, listening to the dry, tinny whispers of the girls around me in the cabin, a sound as soothing as the tide. But I awakened upright, freezing, and surrounded by the kind of darkness insomniacs long for, matte, consuming oblivion. How could I have known that they'd seen? Around me was not the absence of sound, but the sound of absence, a voluptuous silence that pressed against my eardrums. Then, a pulse of wind goaded the tree branches, and there was a groan, a whispery shimmer of leaves. I trembled. I wanted to look up for a moon or stars or something to tell me where I was, but I was rigid with terror. How could I have known that they had guided my trusting, sleepwalking body out of the cabin and through the forest? That they crouched mere feet away, watching my form suspended in the clearing, circling slowly in the blackness like an errant satellite. My body was so cold, it felt like it was disappearing at the edges, like my shoreline was evaporating. It was the opposite of pleasure, which had pumped blood through me and warmed my body like the mammal I was. But here, I was just skin, then just muscle, and then merely bone. I felt like my spine was pulling up into my skull, each vertebra click-click-clicking like a car slowly ascending a roller coaster's first hill. And then I was just a hovering brain, and then a consciousness, floating and fragile as a bubble. And then I was nothing. Only then did I understand. Only then did I see the crystal outline of my past and future, conceive of what was above me, innumerable stars, incalculable space, and what was below me, miles of mindless dirt and stone. I understood that knowledge was a dwarfing, obliterating, all-consuming thing, and to have it was both to be grateful and suffer greatly. I was a creature so small, trapped in some crevice of an indifferent universe. But now, I knew. I heard a light crescendo of laughter, running footsteps. I wanted to call out to them, "I see you, friends. I know you're there. This hilarious prank will only make me stronger in the end, and for that I should certainly thank you, friends. Friends?" But I only managed a half-moaned exhalation. Something pushed through the underbrush coming toward me. Not a girl, not an animal, but something in between. I came back into myself and began to scream. I screamed and screamed, and when the leaders got there, the beams of their flashlights bobbing in the dark like demented fireflies, one of them tried to keep me from frightening the others by sealing the fissure of my mouth with her palm. I fought her like a wild thing, an explosion of limbs and kicking. Then I went limp. They carried me back to the cabin, and though my numb limbs barely perceived their touch, I was grateful for the assistance. The next morning, the leaders told me I'd sleepwalked deep into the woods. They let me rest, and when I woke again, a fever had taken me. My awakening had been so severe, it provoked in my body an immune reaction, a summoning of antibodies that clashed with this new information like armies on a medieval battlefield. I lay there, imagining the script of the conversation they'd all shared as I'd shuffled deeper and deeper into the trees. I slept and dreamt of a room full of owls regurgitating onto the floor pellets that, when open, revealed the skulls of rabbits. I woke up with long scratches down my arms. The tree branches? My own fingernails? No one would tell me. Once I awoke to see a body in the doorway, backlit by soft autumn light. "I'm sorry," she said. "You deserved better than that. Better than..." From behind her, there was a murmur, and the door swung shut. Later, the adults conferred with each other in the next room about my situation, and agreed that I was not ready for camping. At least not that year. The next day, Mrs. Z drove me down the mountain early, back to my parents' house. I slept on and off for many days, insisting on doing so on my bedroom floor in my sleeping bag. And when my fever broke, I pulled my shaking body up to the vanity, glanced into the mirror, and for the first time, saw who I'd been looking for. When I came to the table for dinner, I realized Lydia was not among us. There was not even a place setting for her. "Where is Lydia?" I asked. Anil frowned. "She left," she said. "She left?" Anil was trying not to be unkind, I could tell. "I think she was exhausted and sick. So she left early, drove back to Brooklyn." "And upset," said Diego. "She was upset about the rabbit." The painter sliced into her beef, which was rarer than I would have thought safe to eat. "Oh, well," she said, her voice throaty and clear. "Not everybody's cut out for this, I guess." My wine glass had tipped over, though I didn't remember it tipping over. The stain spread away from me like blood, predictably. "What did you say?" I said to the painter. She looked up from her fork, where a cube of red beef was leaking onto her plate. "I said, not everybody's cut out for this, I guess." It was the first sentence of hers that stayed in my mind the way speech should. She pushed the meat between her lips and began to chew. I could hear the crushing, tearing force of her mastication as clearly as if she was gnawing on my throat. A chill rippled underneath my shoulder blades, as if I were under the grip of a new fever. "Is that from something?" I asked her. "That sentiment, a show, or..." She put her fork down on her plate and swallowed. "No. Are you accusing me of something?" "No, I just..." The faces of the group were knitted in confusion, glossed with concern. I stood up and backed away from the table. When I pushed the chair back into its place, the screech caused everyone to flinch. "Don't be afraid," I said to them. "I'm not. Not anymore." I hurried out of the room and out of the front door, down the steps, tumbling onto the lawn and scrambling to my feet. Behind me, Benjamin began to jog down the steps. "Stop!" he shouted. "Come back! Just let me..." I turned and ran for the trees. In the realm of sense and reason, it seemed logical for something to make sense for no reason, natural order, or not make sense for some reason, the deliberate design of deception. But it seemed perverse to have things make no sense for no reason. What if you colonize your own mind, and when you get inside, the furniture is attached to the ceiling? What if you step inside, and when you touch the furniture, you realize it's all just cardboard cutouts, and it all collapses beneath the pressure of your finger? What if you get inside, and there's no furniture? What if you get inside and it's just you in there, sitting in a chair rolling figs and eggs around in the basket of your lap and humming a little tune? What if you get inside and there's nothing there, and then the door hatch closes and locks? What is worse, being locked outside of your own mind or being locked inside of it? What is worse, writing a trope, or being one? What about being more than one? I walked to my cabin for the last time. I finally added my name to the tablet above my desk. C.M., I scrawled. Resident colonist, and colonizing resident, and madwoman in her own attic. I threw my novel notes and laptop into the lake. After the plush splash subsided, I heard the sound of girls laughing. Or maybe it was just the birds. I drove away from Devil's Throat in the early morning darkness. The car barreled down the road that had once seemed so lush and inviting, and as I descended the mountain, I felt as if I was being rewound back to the beginning. Not just the beginning of the summer, but of my life. The trees whipped past, the same trees that I had observed from a middle-aged woman's car. Now I was that woman, but I was speeding wildly, and the trees flashed by so fast I felt nauseated. No limpid daughter slept in the back seat. No strange teenage girl sat next to me, stewing in her own nightmarish consciousness. And isn't that how you become tender? Vulnerable? The tissue-softening marination of your own mind? The quicksand of mental indulgence? I needed to be home. I needed to be home with my wife, in our home in civilization and away from other artists, at least the sort of artists who cloister themselves from the rest of the world. Dying profession, dead hotels. I had been foolish. After I passed through Y, an orange-limbed sign sat on the side of the road. Speed limit, 45, it read. Beneath, a dark-paneled digital screen was waiting for drivers to approach, to admonish by blinking, or praise by not blinking. As I approached, I waited for my own car, now pushing 60, to register. But the panel remained dark. As I zipped past, I felt a strange sensation, as if someone were pressing a thin membrane to my throat, and I was inhaling no air. The thought came so suddenly upon me that my car almost veered off the side of the road. I pressed my fingers to my throat, where my pulse hummed beneath my skin. Fast, but there. I was alive, surely. How much time had passed since I departed our little house, since I'd seen my wife's face? What if I'd misstepped and overshot her lifetime, Rip Van Winkled myself away from her in an irreversible act? I pressed on my brake once, twice, and the dark road behind me flooded red. The light revealed a herd of deer moving liquidly over the pavement, eyes glinting with each tap. 2 hours later, I pulled the car up next to the curb. People drifted along the street, stood on their lawns watching me. I could not remember if these were the neighbors from before. It seemed like a lifetime since I had last seen their front doors and fences. I stepped out of the car and approached our home, where a woman in a blue dress was kneeling in the dirt, a sun hat concealing her face. My wife was always a morning planter, finding the cool, thin dawn air to be bracing and healthful. She had a dress like that, and a hat. Was that her? Did her shoulders bend and crook with advanced age, or merely with the exhaustion of being married to someone like me? I walked up to the sidewalk and called her name. The woman stiffened, and as her head rose up, her sun hat tilted, too. I waited for the outline of her face to emerge from beneath the brim, to assure me I was still needed, to assure me I was still here. I know what you're thinking, reader. You're thinking, does this woman have the temperament to come to our residency, having failed so thoroughly at this one? Surely she is too fragile, too sick, too mad to eat and sleep and work among other artists. Or, if you're being a little less generous, perhaps you're thinking that I'm a cliché, a weak, trembling thing with a silly root of adolescent trauma, straight out of a gothic novel. But I ask you, readers, thus far in your jury deliberations, have you encountered any others who have truly met themselves? Some, I'm sure, but not many. I have known many people in my lifetime, and rarely do I find any who have been taken down to the quick, pruned, so that their branches might grow back healthier than before. I can tell you, with perfect honesty, that the night in the forest was a gift. Many people live and die without ever confronting themselves in the darkness. Pray that one day you will spin around at the water's edge, lean over, and be able to count yourself among the lucky. Difficult at parties. Afterward, there is no kind of quiet like the one that is in my head. Paul brings me home from the hospital in his ancient Volvo. The heater is busted and it's January, so there's a fleece blanket wedged at the foot of the passenger seat. My body radiates pain, is dense with it. He buckles my seatbelt. His hands are shaking. He lifts the blanket and spreads it on my lap. He's done this before, wrapping it snug around my thighs while I make jokes about being a kid getting tucked into bed. He is cautious and fearful now. "Stop," I say, and I do it myself. It is Tuesday. I think it's Tuesday. The condensation on the inside of the car has frozen. The snow outside is sullied, a dark yellow line carved into its depths. The wind rattles the broken door handle. Across the way, a teenage girl shouts to her friend three unintelligible syllables. Tuesday is speaking to me, in Tuesday's voice. "Open up," it says. "Open up." Paul reaches for the ignition. Around the hole, there are scratches in the plastic, where I imagine that in his rush to get me, the key had missed its destination over and over again. The engine struggles a little, as if it doesn't want to wake up. The first night, back in my house, he stands in the doorway of the bedroom with his wide shoulders hunched inward and asks me where I want him to sleep. "With me," I say, as if it's a ridiculous question. "Lock the door," I tell him, "and get into bed." The door is locked. "Lock it again." He leaves, and I can hear the stifled jerks of a doorknob being tested. He comes back into the bedroom, flips back the covers, buries himself next to me. I dream of Tuesday. I dream of it from start to finish. When the thin light of morning stretches across the bed, Paul is sleeping in the recliner in the corner of the room. "What are you doing?" I ask, pushing the quilt off my body. "Why are you there?" He tilts his head up. Around his eye, a smoky dark bruise is forming. "You were screaming," he says. "You were screaming, and I tried to hold you, and you elbowed me in the face." This is the first time I actually cry. "I am ready," I tell my black and blue reflection. "Friday." I draw a bath. The water gushes too hot from the spotted faucet. I peel my pajamas away from my body and they fall like sloughed skin to the tiled floor. I half expect to look down and see the cage of my ribs, the wet balloons of my lungs. Steam rises from the bath. I remember a small version of myself, sitting in a hotel hot tub and holding my arms rigid against my torso, rolling around in the churning water. "I'm a carrot!" I shriek at a woman, who might be my mother. "Add some salt! Add some peas!" And from her lounge chair, she reaches toward me with her hand contorted, as if around a handle, the very caricature of a chef with a slotted spoon. I add a fat dollop of bubble bath. I slip my foot into the water. There is a second of brilliant heat that slides straight through me, like steel wire through a block of wet clay. I gasp, but do not pause. A second foot, less pain. Hands on the sides of the bathtub, I lower myself down. The water hurts. But it is good. The chemicals in the bubble bath burn. And that is better. I run my toes along the faucet, whispering things to myself, lifting up my breasts with both hands to see how high they can sit. I catch my reflection in the sweaty curve of the stainless steel, tilt my head. On the far side of the tub, I can see the tiny slivers of red polish that have receded from the edges of my toenails. I feel buoyant, bodiless. The water gets too high and threatens the lip of the tub. I turn the faucet off. The bathroom echoes unpleasantly. I hear the front door open. I tense until I hear the rattle of keys on the hallway table. Paul comes into the bathroom.
Hey,
he says.
Hey,
I say. You had a meeting.
What?
You had a meeting. You're wearing a dress shirt. He looks down at himself.
Yes,
he says slowly, as if he didn't believe his shirt had existed until now.
Actually, he says, I went and looked at a few apartments.
I don't want to move, I tell him.
You should find another place.
He says this firmly, as if he had spent his entire day building up to this sentence. I shouldn't do anything, I say. I don't want to move.
I think it's a bad idea to stay. I can help you find a new apartment.
I wind a hand into my hair and pull it away from my skull in a wet sheet. A bad idea for whom? We stare at each other. My other arm is crossed over my chest. I let it drop. Unplug the tub for me? I ask. He kneels in the cold puddle on the tile next to the tub. He unbuttons the sleeve at his wrist and begins to roll it up in a neat, tight coil. He reaches past my legs into the water still thick with bubbles, down to the bottom. Suds catch on the roll of fabric around his upper arm. I can feel the syncopated drumming of his fingers as he fumbles for the beaded chain, weaves it around them, pulls. There is a low pop. A lazy bubble of air breaks the water's surface. He withdraws, and his hand brushes my skin. I jump, and then he jumps. My face is level with his shins when he stands. There are wet circles on the knees of his dress pants. You're spending a lot of time away from your place, I say. I don't want you to feel like you have to spend every night here. He frowns.
It doesn't bother me, he says. I want to help.
He vanishes into the hallway. I sit there until all of the water drains, until the last milky swirl disappears down the silver mouth, and I feel a strange shiver that starts deep within me. The spine should not be so afraid. The receding bubbles leave strange white striations on my skin, like the tide-scarred sand at the beach's edge. I feel heavy. Weeks pass. The officer who'd taken my statement in the hospital calls to say she might have me come in to identify someone. Her voice is generous, too loud. Later, she leaves a clipped message on the answering machine, telling me it's not necessary. The wrong person, not the right one.
Maybe he left the state, Paul says.
I stay away from myself. Paul stays away, too. I don't know who is more afraid, he or I. We should try something, I say one morning. About this. I gesture to the space in front of me. He looks up from an egg.
Yes,
he says. We lay out suggestions on a hot pink post-it note that is too small for many solutions. I place an order for a DVD from a company that advertises adult films for loving couples. It arrives in a plain brown box, neatly placed on the corner of the cement stoop in front of my apartment. When I pick it up, the box is lighter than I expect. I tuck it under my arm and fiddle with the doorknob for a moment. The new deadbolt sticks. I put the box on the kitchen table. Paul calls.
I'm coming over soon, he says.
His voice always sounds immediate, present, even when he's speaking over the phone.
Did you get the...
Yeah, I say. It's here. It will take him at least 15 minutes to get to this side of town. I go to the box and open it. The number of limbs tangled on the front cover doesn't appear to match the number of faces. I count. Twice. And confirm that there is one extra elbow and one extra leg. I open the case. The disc smells brand new and doesn't snap easily from its plastic knob. The shiny side gleams like an oil slick and reflects